Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about three relatively new shows.
Yes.
So be prepared. Of course, one of them is Star Wars.
And one of them is an animated comic book TV series, to which I'm going to port something to you that I was not expecting in 2024 for that one. But before we get to that, is there any news that we have other than us like you know, we really should have recorded our preamble for football because people would have been so pissed at us just talking random ass football shit because we were watching the game last
week. I got something kind of news, kind of football related. Okay. I meant to text you about this. Our favorite hard luck loser, Joe Burrow, did something a couple of weeks ago. That's the quarterback for the Bungles, who, despite having a fucking MVP season, cannot win a game. Joe Burrow, feel bad for the man. If Atlanta wanted Joe Burrow, I would be so happy. I enjoy watching him play. I feel horrible for him. But apparently he was mic'd up in practice or something. Or maybe pregame. This was like a week or maybe 2 weeks ago. I don't know. It just broke, I think, this week. And he was bragging, like kind of bragging to his teammates that he bought one of the tumblers that Warner Brothers put on sale. They had what, like five or six, I think?
Yes.
Of the Batman tumblers from the Nolan movies. And they decided to sell them off, and Joe Burrow bought one.
everybody's saying that he's going to roll into the Steelers game this with it, and he's going to be wearing the Bane mask. That's what everybody wants him to do, because you know the Steelers, Pittsburgh was the primary place where Dark Knight Rises was filmed in the Pittsburgh Heinz Stadium. I think it is the where what's his name?
It's where that whole thing was filmed. That whole stadium, and like one of the Steelers players is, I forget who it was.
I can't remember who it was either. But
it's like in that shot. From that
where
scene.
He blows it up.
So yeah. That would be pretty interesting. From what I understand, those aren't street legal. He'd probably have to be like brought in there on a flatbed, but it would be really cool. So either Joe Burrow is a nerd like us, which I could see that, or he's a really big fan of those movies, which kind of still makes him a nerd like us. But it was an interesting little, like, oh no shit. I mean, I don't know. It didn't blow me away. It was just this thing of like, I feel connected to this guy now, because 100% if I was in his shoes and was making all that money, the minute they announced those things, I would have been like, I'm buying one. Like, I would have done that dumb shit with popular. My money.
it's kind of great that, like, I just love the fact that this man makes like $40 million a year just alone in his salary. And the thing that he decides to buy is the fucking tumbler. The real, like, an actual, like, working tumbler. Like, that's hilarious. And he is having an MVP-type season. I mean, like, he's already eclipsed, like at this point in the season where there's two-thirds of the season left, there's a third of the season left, there's six more games left for them, he's already at the amount of touchdowns that he's had his entire career. Like, like the most he's had, like he's at 30 right now. And I think the biggest was the 2022 season when they went to, when they had that wild ass Chiefs game where the 10 points in 5 seconds game.
That's a legendary. Yeah. It was like the Chiefs Buffalo game where something similar happened. It's like those were wild games.
Those are games that 30 for 30 documentaries get made about. Like, that's honestly, that is the like those games, like I will, the 2022 season will probably go down for me as one of the most amazing seasons that we've ever seen, just for nail biters, not my team in particular, but just
mine either.
Like, you know, but just watching, like, if you weren't a football fan and you decided to start watching that year because they're like, you know,
and like, wow, is football like this all the time? No, it's not.
It's not even fucking close to this. This is
college football, maybe, but yeah, professional football, no.
Not at all. Like, but I mean, it's weird because it's like, it's so funny because it, like, that season feels like the end game season. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, we're never going to get that again.
If that was the like series finale of the NFL, would have been like, oh, that was crazy. That was great.
Yeah. It made all the sense, right? Like it all fit together. Like it was wild. Like, but yeah, Joe Burrow, like, is probably going to go to another team. He's probably going to request a trade. I'm fairly certain because like, you know, you're just hitting, like, he's 27. So like, he's like literally in that same spot that, like, you know, his contemporaries are, like, you know, his contemporaries are Jordan Love, Lamar Jackson, and Josh Allen, right? Like, all of them are like chasing Patrick Mahomes. Like, they're chasing Jordan basically. And I love the fact that these guys, no matter, like these guys are like elite quarterbacks, and if Mahomes and the Chiefs weren't there, they would probably all be sharing Super Bowl wins over the last like 4 years, right? Yeah. 2020, 21, 22, and 23. They would have all shared, respectively, all have gotten rings. But I mean, Lamar Jackson, two MVPs, and he can't close it. Like, it's wild to me that these guys, like, I now know what my dad meant in the 80s when it was like, like, you had all these great quarterbacks, but fucking Joe motherfucking Montana.
Like, yeah, it's just like watching a bunch of Dan Marinos play for teams that are like, aren't what they should be, but they have quarterbacks that are amazing. And it's just like, but the Chiefs got it. I mean, you know,
fucking Mahomes and Reed. It's just like Walsh. Like, I hate Walsh. Like, as an adult now, like, as a kid, I loved the 49ers because it annoyed my dad to no end that the Niners always won. Always won. Boomer didn't win one. Dan didn't win one. Kelly didn't win one. The only one that won one was Sims. And he won two. Just like Eli won two during the Manning era, during the whatchamacallit era. Even Elway had to wait until the end of his career, end of his fucking career to win one because Joe Montana and the Niners were so just dominant during that time. And it's like, we're seeing this again. It's just, it's the Chiefs.
It's just a newer cycle of like, when we were kids, it was the 49ers and the Cowboys, and like, those were the dynasties. And now, you know, now we're just seeing it with a couple of newer, specifically the Chiefs. So
the Chiefs. So anywho, sorry.
But we
tried so hard not to do the football shit, but we don't care.
I'm happy that something good happened for Joe Burrow this year.
seriously, like the kid cannot get a break. Like, but the funniest part is that when he's winning, I really don't like him because he's so swaggy. He's so kind of like, it's disingenuous. It's like, you know, like Kurt Tenchains, like Kurt, like once he got started winning, like, the team kind of pushed him, and it kind of became this kind of Fitzmagic, though Fitzmagic of the white quarterbacks with swag, Fitzmagic is my favorite because he never won anything, but he still swagged, right?
Yeah.
But it's like when Joe Burrow swags, it's that LSU, I fucking hate you swag. Because, like, I don't like LSU at all. Like, I've never liked their programs, anything. Maybe their gymnastics and maybe their women's basketball. But everything else, I've never been a fan of it. I didn't even like LSU when Shaq was playing. I mean, you remember when we were kids, like Shaq, like as soon as he got to the Magic, I loved him, right? Like who didn't love Shaq when we were kids? But it's, I don't know, man, it's that swag. Once he starts winning, I'm like, oh man, fucking stop. I hate your swag. I hate your fucking like little moves and stuff. Just sit down, calm down, Drake, calm down. But yeah.
So before we get into the three shows we want to talk about, I should have started with this. First, I'm an idiot. So
aren't you an idiot?
You're the only person I knew that two things, that went and saw Moana 2 and talked about seeing Moana 2. Apparently everybody else just went to see Moana 2 and nobody talked about it. Because I was talking about, like, I don't know, I guess it's doing all right. No, it was like made like $200 million. So yeah. What do I know? But literally, there's none of my social media feeds is anybody talking about, like, man, went to go see Moana 2. But it made so much money.
There was no cultural imprint. Like, there was no footsteps, no cultural footprint. None.
Not even like Avatar, like kind of like that cut, like first week, like, oh God, I went and saw it. It's awesome. It's made a shit ton of money, and nobody I know is talking about it. They went to go see it. I asked like five people at work. I was like, did you go see Moana 2? They're like, nah, I'll probably. This one lady was like, I'm going to try to take my grandkids to see it this weekend. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, how did this make $200 million? But hey, you know, great. Moana 2, although everybody has the same complaint you have, the songs are terrible. Everything I read after the fact was like, yeah, the movie's fine, but the songs are terrible. Holy shit, it made a lot of money. So I was wrong.
Okay, well, side note, like, sidebar. I was going to ask you, because, okay, so, like, I finally read some stuff up about why Lin-Manuel wasn't going to do it, and it brings up something that we never talked about, but I've been, like, it's been... I don't even think anybody knows. Like, it's been my primary, like, when I first listened to it, I was like, okay. But then I started listening to it more and more, and it became like this thing for me. And now it's a thing. So Lin-Manuel, like, he's doing the, like, he officially had done the whatchamacallit. He was doing the live action Moana. So, like, he was preoccupied with that. He supposedly has a secret Broadway show that he's making. But then also, the thing that I don't know if we've ever talked about was, did you have a listen to his Warriors musical adaptation?
No.
So he, in secret and in private over the last year or so, has been working on this project for the Warriors, and basically had made a musical version of the Warriors using many, many of the, it's an all-female cast, which it never is pronounced that it is that, but it is. And it's basically an adaptation of Walter Hill's 1980 classic. And it's done in, like, this is where it'll probably get you. And it got me. At first I was like, what the fuck is this, man? I don't know if I like this, but then I kept on listening to it. And now it's like this earbug for me. It's probably my favorite album of the year, other than maybe the Kendrick album. But I haven't listened to the Kendrick album a lot, as much as I listened to this Warriors thing. It's this combination of both, like early 2000s hip hop and early 2000s punk rock, like, but more like My Chemical Romance and that era. And then you're talking about, like, you know, the Warrior, like the rap stuff is a lot, the rap hip hop stuff is a lot of like early 2000s. So it's like Wu-Tang, Mary J. Blige, like rap style. So like it's all this fused into the story of the Warriors. And I mean, the cast he got together for this is fucking amazing. And I'm surprised that I did not tell you about this. It's on Spotify right now. And it's It's like legit good. It's like, as a Warriors fan, I kind of rejected it at first. I was like, no, fuck this. This is just like My Chemical Romance. Why are you doing these My Chemical Romance songs? But then I kind of got the purpose of it, and it's fucking badass, dude. Like, it is really kind
that's of pretty
like,
awesome. Like, yeah. That's one of those things I would go see that. So,
I found out the reason why he didn't work on it.
Yeah, it sucked for Moana too, but
yeah,
I like the guys that wrote the songs are like trying to like semi-defend that they're not that good.
it's
pretty funny.
Yeah, it really is. I'm like, you know, and I think I said this during our discussion of it. Why didn't you get the fucking Andersons? Literally,
yeah.
You like have them stomp whatever live action stuff they're doing for Frozen live action and whatever they're doing for Frozen 3. Have them stomp it full stop. Get these TikTok artists off the fucking stage and put the Andersons
probably
on.
Probably money, because I mean we talked. We don't need to re, you know.
Yeah.
Iterate on, but like it this move, the way they announced this movie, it definitely felt like this was originally a straight to Disney Plus thing, and they were like, oh, mm-hmm. no, we're not doing that, we're putting it in theaters. So I imagine that's probably why it's a damn near finished project when they announced it. So yeah, it's yeah, and I would say probably just money, and they're like, oh, well, it's finished, so this is what we're going with. Mm-hmm. A couple of other things. One, I know I've talked about From before. They just had their Series 3 finale. They did get picked up for a Season 4.
Nice.
Yeah, unfortunately, the show takes so long to make. It'll be 2026 before we see it. But bonus, that gives you 2 years to catch up on 30 some odd episodes of TV that are fucking fantastic. It's the show The Walking Dead wishes it could have been after season one. It's not a zombie show, but it's that kind of like dealing with the people and the horror element of it. And like those dynamics, it does it so well. But it also only does like 10 episodes every like 14 months. So whereas The Walking Dead, it was just like, oh, people like this more. Doesn't matter how good it is. The other thing is last week, I almost called it Lois and Clark, Superman and Lois. had its series finale.
Yes, it did.
And I know not a lot of people were watching the show. It's fine. I understand why, multiple reasons why the show had to end. That's fine too. I was blown away by what they were able to accomplish. First of all, they did full on like Superman Doom. They kind of had the Superman Doomsday thing going since last year. And like Superman died, he came back. They end the series, spoilers, but Lex brings Doomsday back. It's very comic book accurate in that like you can't really kill Doomsday. You kill him, and then he comes back, and he's stronger. And that's kind of the whole thing of Doomsday. And so they have a fight that lasts most of the episode. This is a television show with a television budget. And there aren't, like, long, like, shots of just Doomsday. There's only a few, like, solid, like, full-on close-ups of the CGI Doomsday. It is at leaps and bounds better than the Zack Snyder version of this, which I don't want to lay that all on Zack Snyder. He's not necessarily a, like, he is a visual effects guy in that, much like Cameron, but I know he's not the one making the effects, and ultimately he left like a lot of that. It is what it is, but that it's so fucking good. But better than that, like the Doomsday fight is great. They do a lot of wonderful things. The show ends with this like 5-minute montage of, you remember the end of Parks and Rec, where it goes like through like what's going to happen to these characters, and
it's the Animal House thing, and then
Bluto
Bartolus was never found again. Absolutely.
But you know, in that the sentimental way, so it touches, again, spoilers, touches on Lois's death, how it affects Clark, what his sons grow up to be, what the characters we've kind of seen, what happens to them, and ultimately, and it's interesting because it's Clark or Superman narrating it. He's talking about the end of his own life and what happens when he dies, and it shows him literally dying and passing on to the afterlife and like reuniting with all of the people that had passed on before him. And it is incredibly moving. Specifically, there is a moment where like he does defeat Doomsday. It's actually really emotional when he defeats Doomsday. You know, well before this, he has to take him into space and to the sun and throw him into the sun. But you had to have been watching the show to understand like this version of Doomsday wasn't created in a lab. It was actually a version, an alternate universe version of Superman that got brought here from another dimension. So like as it burns away, it's like he's seeing himself. So that's emotional. But he puts Lex in prison. And there's this moment at the end where he's passing on and he's talking about what life really is all about. And one of the things he touches on is forgiveness. And there is this moment between him and their Lex Luthor that is like, it hit me like a fucking ton of bricks, man. I cannot explain it. James Gunn has his work cut out for him. Hush. I swear. A car drove by my house, so.
Oh, man.
Or maybe she's just making sure I don't get too choked up talking about Superman and Lois. It's so good. And, I mean, really better than it had any right to be. It, after, like, again, we both enjoy Man of Steel, but we would both agree it's not really what you want from a Superman movie. Like, it takes this, it's like all heart, man. And I'm excited to see what Gunn does, but like, I'm going to be watching that movie with this series in the back of my mind. Like, it has to do better than that. There's also a really sweet moment. You would love this. When Lois dies, he's talking about, in the show, she had cancer, and it was this constant fight of, you know, it came back, it's in remission, it came back. And ultimately, she dies of cancer, and he talks about how lonely he was after. And so he finally did something he never thought he'd do, and he got a dog. And there's this like minute and a half where he's talking about having a dog and how he can't believe he never had a dog. Also really hit me because Ripley's my first, like, my dog. And I understand that, where it's like, I'm 45 and I'm like, why did I should have done this when I was 25. Like, I don't know if I could have dealt with the emotion, the emotions of losing a loved, a beloved pet, but I don't know how I would deal with that. But also, I don't know how I lived a life without this creature by my side all the time. Like, it's such a great show, and it had such a perfect ending, which was honestly rare for this Arrowverse kind of CW superhero thing. None of those shows really ended well. They all started didn't. Well, but yes. None of them ended well. Well, except maybe Batwoman. Batwoman kind of overall was not great. Black Lightning had a pretty good run. But it was just one of those where like almost nobody was watching. So. Watching
it, yeah, and it only lasted what, 2 seasons? Like,
three. I think Black Lightning was 3. Batwoman was 2, maybe. 2.
Okay.
Or maybe Black Lightning was 4 and Batwoman was 3. It's something like that. So
yeah.
But yeah, none of them have phenomenal, like perfect, like touchstone endings. This really, really did. And this show is going to be in my mind whenever we see James Gunn's Superman next year. So the other thing I wanted to bring up is I started watching Cross. I texted you this.
Yes, you did.
On Amazon Prime. And man, it is one of the most uneven crime thriller type shows I think I've ever watched.
Oh man, I was hoping that it would do the thing that they did with Reacher, which is like give us a really great fucking show, like a consistent, like, you know, start small and work their way into something bigger, because that's the way that they did with Reacher, which is they took a very, very small story, but they did it right. Oh man, that really, because I mean, I love Aldous. Oh God, I want to call him Aldous Huxtable, but that's the
Aldous writer. Hodge.
Yeah, Aldous
he Hall. Was one of the bright spots in the Black Adam film.
Yes, so. He was like maybe the only him and a couple of more and him and fucking James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, like were the only bright spots in that freaking. Oh my God, let's not bring up Black Adam again. But yeah, like okay, so. Is it the tone? Is it the writing? Like, what is it? Because, like, I've always felt like the Alex Cross stuff, like, other than the original, like, the very first Kiss the Girls, the Morgan Freeman version of it, they have not been able to land, like, even the sequel.
A Long Time, a Spider.
A Spider? That was terrible, dude. Like,
yeah, and what's his name?
Yeah, Madea, Tyler Perry.
Tyler Perry tried to adapt it, and so it's not Aldous Hodge. He's fine. It's just not written great. Like I don't. It's hard to put like a my finger on exactly what it is, but. I don't know. It does specifically, and I'm almost at the end. I've got a few episodes, like 2 episodes left. There's a thing in episode 8 where, like, he's the hero of the story. He's telling everybody, like, he's been lauded the whole series. Like, every time anybody meets him, I'm like, oh, you're the famous Alex Cross. And he gets to a moment where he's kind of at this party and, like, unmasks the villain and is telling everybody that this high society person you think is so great is actually a serial killer, and everybody's like, okay, you've had too much to drink. What? Like,
what?
Yes.
So wait, that's how they deflect?
Yeah.
Oh man. It's
very, very, like, that's the kind of unevenness of it. Oh. And like that's the peak of it right there, where I'm just like, I get that that you want to like they're trying to do this whole like, oh, he's lost his wife. He's been on edge for over a year now because of her death, and like they try to paint it as it's like he's become erratic, but the problem is they don't do anything previous to that in this world for all the characters to then turn on him like that. Like it just feels really sudden. It's uneven. He gives a really, really good performance. There's moments of really good stuff here, and maybe if it does get a second season, it will be better. But reminded me of, there's another show, Will Trent, that I've talked about before. It reminded me a lot of that, where it's like there's really good stuff here, and most of the acting is great. The villain in this season is giving a like they could have put Anthony Starr in here because that's the kind of like psychosociopath thing they're going for. And he looks Anthony Starr-ish. Yeah, it's just ultimately it's just uneven, man. There's no real detective work going on. I don't think it's the solid adaptation that fans of that character deserve. I mean, it's kind of like it's there if you need something to fill some time with, like, because it's too damn cold outside. So, but I don't know. I'm gonna finish it because I was 3 or 4 episodes in when I was like, I don't know if this is that great. And by the time I got to like episode 7, I was like, eh, I might as well finish it. So, but he's really good and he deserves better than what this show is giving him. So, yeah. So, I should have started with that so that we could dovetail the DC stuff into the actual DC show that we're going to talk about. But whatever. James Gunn, new show, Creature Commandos, first 2 episodes streaming on HBO Max. We both watched it yesterday.
Yes, we did. And I did not expect necrophilia on my bingo card for a superhero film, a superhero series, especially one from DC. The taste that we got, the 2-episode taste, like when it's this good, it really, really, really makes me want to like have the whole series to watch all in one gulp, because it feels like this is more of a 4-hour-long animated series, like movie, than it does feel like a like 8-episode TV series, because it's so, it feels like it's so far, it feels like it's so interconnected.
So
I
here's what's
really enjoyed it.
really, really in like for me at least interesting. It's not necessarily the show itself. They're leading up to this, it's like James Gunn's DCU like starts with Creature Commandos. What this show definitely establishes is that that is not true. James Gunn's DCU started with James Gunn's The Suicide Squad,
Suicide Squad. Yes.
which led
Because
into Peacemaker, which led into this, because they're all connected.
this is very preambly, like this is very kind of like let's set the let's do a soft, it's a very soft reboot. Like he took his he took the things that like he created and put them in there. And like, can we just talk about how, okay, I'm going to say something that is not crass. It is a little like you got to check yourself, gun, but also, okay. It's very weird to see James Gunn go really hard into the Stan stuff because of the opening sequence. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like he's decided to make himself like an accountable character within the DCU by having himself shown as the creator and written by person in the animated title sequence. It's so fucking wild. Like, I do like that he gives his voice actors credit at the beginning, something that does never happen in a TV series, like an animated TV series. Like, you don't get this whole thing of, like, you know, and David Harbour as Frankenstein, you know, like, or, you know, Frank Grillo as Randall Flagg Sr. Like, you've never gotten something like that. So, like, even from the beginning and the get-go, this is like James Gunn going, this is me. I'm going to be, like, for better or for worse, I'm going to be held accountable. And it's kind of
wild. It is much like the Suicide Squad. Like, yep. You watch it and you'll be like, that's definitely something that James Gunn wrote.
Yep. No, you absolutely. And it's not insulting. Like, I want to make people understand. It's not crass. It's just literally, like,
well, the show itself is crass. But
yeah, the show itself is very crass. Like, though it makes some very, like, it makes some very salient points with being super funny. And if this is the way that he's going to approach critique of things, man, we are going to be in for some wild ass things because it's super funny. Like, from the opening moment, like, it was like James Gunn knew exactly what everybody needed and they needed to laugh because, like, this whole, like, the whole storyline, like, what it revolves around. Like, what starts the inciting incidents for Creature Commandos with, is it Hera? Or is it, I can't think of her name. Cersei. Aligning herself with the sons of Themyscira. The sons
of
Themyscira.
Yeah.
And all the bullshit. Like, but it's done with such a funny, like, arched, like, I don't give a fuck tone. It's wild. Like, and that's just the beginning of it. Like, the Eric Frankenstein stuff is fucking wild, dude. Too. Like, wow.
Indira Varma as the bride is, it's gonna make me sound like a fruitcake, but, like, that's a hot character, man. And she is, like, bringing so much to that. It's just like, God, I kind of want to see this in live action, man.
I said, guys, I mean, we're spoiling this. Like, the whole thing of, like, I did not see necrophilia on my bingo card in 2024 from DC. Her and Frankenstein, like, her and Dr. Frankenstein, not Eric.
Yeah.
Holy shit. But it also fucking, like, hurts when David Harbour's dumb as a fucking post, like monster literally fucking kills Frankenstein. They make fun of it and they make light of fun of it. But I mean, that's, like, the through line to me that was like, oh shit, Gunn gets it. Like, Gunn gets how to make a critique of a certain type of person, like, without it ever being, it's critical, but it's done with such a deft touch. Like, that whole ending sequence of episode 2, where they're running through, where the bride and Frankenstein are running, and Eric Frankenstein are running through time, and he's Pepe Le Pewing it.
Yeah.
Like, it, like, not only does it recontextualize the universal Bride of Frankenstein for me, because it was like, oh shit, this is all about fucking, oh man, this is all a fucking incel-y fucking stalker fucking shit. I never even fucking thought about that. Shame on me.
Yeah.
But the way he does it as, like, a montage of, like, literally an updated Pepe Le Pew, but it being so fucking critical of then, I mean, like, slow clap. Like, that was, like, that was not what I was expecting. Like, he earns the dirty fucking, the dirty cartoon sex scene because of what comes after.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I'll be surprised if he doesn't, like, take some flack for some of the things that happen, especially with, like, Rick Flagg Sr. and the princess. Like, it gets a little, like, but it's also, like, that's true to kind of, like, life, you know? Yeah. Like, if it makes you feel dirty, it's probably because, you know, you fall in that spectrum. So
exactly. Like, I mean, like her having, like, it was hilarious that her, like, her having, it wasn't even daddy issues. She just, like, she was a silver fox chaser. And then, like, him, like, you know, him, like, only doing so much until his, like, you know, his things, like, his, and, like, his urges, like, kind of folded into it.
I did appreciate that, like, from the jump, he's just like, no. But yeah, she's just, like, keeps, and, I mean, what are you gonna do, man? Like,
yeah, but it's also gonna be, I feel like that is going to come back to haunt him, like, because.
For sure.
Like, there's no, like, the way that this show is written is very.
That's a bad decision, and you will pay for that bad decision somewhere down the line. So, yes, like, you let that get the best of you. Like, we can stand here and go, like, yeah, I mean, how many times could you say no, you know, before it's just like, oh, okay. Like, I just got caught up in the moment. But that is a bad decision. You will pay for that later. It's going to be interesting to see what that payment is. Absolutely. You talked about the comedy. So, all the characters have their moments of, like, levity and, like, funny stuff. Like, it's sad, but sad, sweet moment between the bride and the fish lady. I can't think of her name.
Nina Mazursky.
Yeah.
Like, that's what she's just a Nina. Because they don't have, like, an actual creature name for her. But she's the creature from the Black... I mean, she's Ape Sapien. The female Ape Sapien, yeah.
There was a moment at the end of... the very end of the second episode... Yeah. Where the bride... they're both dying. And the bride tries to apologize. And her response is just, fuck you. And it's so... like, it's sad, but funny. And... like, it's just, that got me. But the two comedic performances are Alan Tudyk as Dr. Phosphorus.
The Phosphorus, yes.
And Sean Gunn as G.I. Robot. Like, oh, the is this person a Nazi and Nazi, can I kill them? Never, like, it's only been two episodes, but it did not get old. Like, it's every time, it made me chuckle. Like,
well, I'm going to, I like.
Who is this person? Like, are they a Nazi? Can I kill them? When do I get to kill Nazis?
My favorite part is going to be when G.I. Robot is able to kill Nazis. And the level of ultra violence that Sean Gunn will, or that James Gunn will allow to happen, will be both terrifying and hilarious. Because I guarantee you, this is all, like, it's very much so done in the vein of Peacemaker and the Suicide Squad, not Suicide Squad, but the Suicide Squad, to which, like, let's just appreciate that. I love that he put the in the front of it, because they literally are the Suicide Squad. The other Suicide Squad does not matter. But it's that joke of, like, You hold back, and then once you unleash, you go overboard with it, like the starfish stuff in the Suicide Squad. I feel like G.I. Robot is going to have that moment, and we are all going to love it, that he is going to fucking literally turn whoever they say are Nazis into puddles of bile, gross gore with his gun, with his handgun. Literally his handgun. It's hilarious. It, like, I'm glad, like, the easy thing would have been to have Alan Tudyk play G.I. Robot, and I'm glad they didn't, because, you know, how many robots can Alan Tudyk play? The answer is all of them. But I like the fact that, like, he's given his, like, his brother, at first it was a joke that he kept on giving his brother shit to do in movies, but it's come to a point now where Sean Gunn is in the MCU without having James Gunn there.
I think, like, Sean Gunn, like, I get why people are kind of like that whole Nepo thing. Like, I get it, but I have felt for a long time that this dude is underrated as a performer overall. I mean, he was in the Gilmore Girls, you know?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
And, like, he's done a lot more than, you know, people realize. He's not just, oh, he gets work because he's James Gunn's brother. He does get work because he's James Gunn's brother, but he doesn't just get work because he's James. Like, he's in a lot of things that don't really have anything to do with James Gunn. Like, some of it's, like, you know, small, like, one-off stuff in TV shows, but
yeah,
you know, he's a solid actor, and he's a great comedic performer.
He really is. Like, and if you've never seen the behind the scenes footage of what Sean Gunn did to play Rocket on set to help the cast on the first two Guardians, all three Guardians, you don't know how much of a MVP and how seriously he takes the craft, because it like it's amazing what he did to make sure that like Rocket was a real character. Like, he is just as much of a part of the performance as Bradley Cooper is. And when you have Bradley fucking Cooper saying the same fucking thing and saying, like, you know, oh no, it's like, it's a combination of me, Sean, the people at ILM in collaboration. Like, that yeah. tells you how good and legit Sean Gunn is. You know, and
he's just doing voice work here. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say just. He's doing the voice work here, but and it's very it's minimal because of who that character is. But he is bringing something to it in the way yeah. he's doing it, and you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I know we're it's such a like an offbeat character and won't. Like, this, it's not going to hit like heights of popularity, but I mean, I would love to see like a live action G.I. Robot with, you know, Sean Gunn in the
mocap.
So, yeah, like it would be great. Like it's such a bizarre show. Like, even with just two episodes, like there's heart, there's humor, there's a lot of uncomfortable shit. There's this moment literally at the beginning of the show where Amanda Waller is like, yeah, all that happened. And they said, we can't use people anymore. These aren't people. And it's Zoe small Stone, like, and quick, but like, it's there for a reason because he's going to show you that these are people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And like, I got spoiled like some of the voice cast that's coming on to do things, and like, don't ruin it yourselves, let it happen for you, because there are some great actors that are from Gunn's world like that have been cast before that are coming very shortly. And one very specific guy who would not be a James Gunn joint unless he actually showed up. I will leave that to everything, but my favorite thing about this whole entire show is it's so like goes down the rabbit hole of like cheap third rate characters that you instantly like, there's, I don't know how he does it, but like, it, maybe it's by the design and it's the voice work, but like instantly you're drawn to these people because they're third rate characters that could die at any time. Like if Bride dies in the next episode, I would not be shocked. And she's out of it for a couple of episodes and they learn how to rebuild her. Like, I would not be surprised, because it's that kind of like, it's literally it's the same thing that he did with the Suicide Squad, which is
thing. It's just like, everybody's like, Pete Davidson's in this movie, has like three lines of dialogue and immediately gets killed. It's lends it to that you never can tell what's going to happen. So, and not in the like, Game of Thrones, like, oh yeah, okay, kind of way. It's just, yeah, you got to expect the unexpected. I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm not in love with the show, but I do think it's a step in the right direction for DC, who, it's kind of been making small steps in the right direction with other properties, Joker 2 aside. But yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm with you. I wish we did have it all at once. I probably would have binged the whole thing, but it's probably better for them to space it out. So maybe it builds some hype for what they're doing. I
Absolutely.
guess only time will tell.
And I want to ask you something, because now that we have something proper, though, there's something that I feel like. So what are the odds that, because Margot Robbie is not going to play, it's all been but confirmed, but Margot Robbie is probably not going to be ever play Harlequin again, even though she set the table for it. How much of a likelihood could it be that it's okay to go because of the opening of animation into live action? Because he's already said the re part of the reason why he cast Frank Grillo was because he wanted, he was going to use it. We actually have seen, we've seen we've seen costume tests, I think, of Grillo. I think that he's supposed to be playing a major role in Peacemaker Part 2 or Season 2, which is the reason why Season 2 is not happening before Superman, which is a weirdly wild thing. But what do we think the odds are that maybe because she's not that much older than, she's a little bit older than Margot Robbie, but she's not wildly inappropriate to play.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past him. I don't know if she would do it.
What if, say, Chuck wrote it, or Chuck Lorre wrote it? I mean, I don't know, you are right. It is a big ask for her, because then it almost it takes her a step back, because it's so much about the physicality. Every time.
She gets to do it already and doesn't have to do the rigorous prep work. She doesn't, not that she's not in shape, just binge watched all of her
She
second
went
season
wild.
of, she still looks fantastic, but it's a whole different thing being in like that outfit and like. I think she'd probably say no. I'm fine just doing our show. I honestly think it'll be a while before we see another live action Harley Quinn.
After Joker
So.
2, absolutely. Which HBO Max, now you guys can watch it on HBO Max starting Friday the 13th. Joker 2.
The perfect way to
They just
kick
found
off
out.
that curse day.
Yes, exactly. With another curse. And two curses do not equal breaking a curse. It just means
Yeah,
that
no, you're just
sucks.
doubly cursed.
Yes, exactly. It's all to say, Creature Commandos is great. And it's a great way to start. You are right. It unintentionally retcons what started
I
the
don't think
gun.
it's unintentional. I think it's completely intentional.
Yeah,
I
that's true.
think it. I mean, there. He's already said there's like a specific part of Peacemaker season one that is not canon, and that's fine. We'll just ignore that part. And I guess it's like in terms of that, there are parts of Suicide Squad that the Suicide Squad that aren't necessarily canon, but. It's still kind of like they specifically reference the Starro incident. And there's definitely pieces of his Peacemaker show, like kind of in the background here. So
Yes.
it's going to be interesting. And he's come out and said, this is probably a good transition, that so I guess somebody the other day asked him about like how it compares to the Marvel stuff, and he said
Yes.
the RDC live action or RDC universe is more like the Star Wars, you know, like what they do with Star Wars, and less like what Marvel does. And in that, like, it's like some things may contradict each other, and we're gonna be okay with that. Yeah, there's a new Star Wars show, Skeleton Crew.
John motherfucking Watts. like I think that's what his name should be now because man, okay, so like there's a lot to unpack here. First off, I'm gonna make a bold prediction and say that all fandom like a certain sector of fandom is just gonna fucking hate this. They're gonna hate
Oh,
it.
absolutely. I mean, nobody hates, this is not my quote, but nobody hates Star Wars as much as Star Wars fans.
No, absolutely. Abso-fucking-lutely. But man, when I was like, let's hope that John Watts goes back to cop car because that's kind of like my favorite thing
is,
he's ever.
man.
It fucking like so people talk about like the Goonies and wanting to make a Goonies movie, but never making a fucking Goonies movie. This motherfucker went back to cop car and basically made a Goonies adventure and set in Star Wars. Like
It's why, like, much like Creature Commandos, I will
yeah.
say up front, I'm not in love with this show yet. Like, I do think there are things, like, it could be a little bit better,
Yeah.
but it does a really good job of creating its own space in the Star Wars universe, playing with the lore of the Star Wars universe, but also not being beholden to the lore.
Yeah, that's the big thing.
The idea of there being like the suburbs, like of Chicago in the Star Wars universe, is fascinating.
Right? Like, oh my God, like the fact that we okay, oh God, there's so much to talk about with this. Like let's just talk about that. Like how you said it's like Chicago or fucking like
It's
I was
like,
getting Colorado vibes from it
or
because of all yeah,
it's
like but you're right, like middle America in Star Wars.
yeah.
That's already like and it tells you up front the Empire has fallen. So like this is post Jedi. This is taking place at the same time that like they really do love this post Jedi like Mandalorian era, right? They really do love the filling in the gaps of this, like doing it basically 20 years, like basically doing the 80s, right? Because that's basically where we are, right? Like we're in the same era as and I love I fucking as soon as I saw it, I literally jumped up and did the fucking Leonardo DiCaprio meme.
The Leo
Yeah, I did the fucking thing. And my wife was like, what the fuck is going on? And I had to explain to her what the Caravan of Courage and the sequel to the Caravan of Courage were and how much they meant to me. And seeing that little fucking dude, oh my
Yeah.
God, dude. Like that's the kind of deep cuts that are in this fucking show. But like going back to like the whole thing of like it being it starts off in this like 80s. Like it's very much in the 80s, right? Like because that's what the ground we're covering because it's like literally around that Caravan of Courage time, right? It kind of allows us to have a throwback without having throwback. Like it's just telling a story, but it's telling a story in the way that like literally Richard Donner did with the Goonies. Like telling a story from the kid's perspective. I like it because it's a different style of storytelling, right? Like we're getting a different look. Like Star Wars school, like did we think that we were ever going to see
Oh,
not like a
Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. First of all, we kind of saw something similar in like The Mandalorian when like Grogu like goes to that class. It's kind of similar, but okay. You were talking about, yes, this is post Empire's Fallen, New Republic. It's where it's firmly set with the New Republic. And I guess we will find out more because the planet they live on also like may be something else entirely.
Treasure planet.
But the indoctrination of these kids into the New Republic is equally as disturbing as the like might makes right of the Empire. Like this whole like everybody has something to contribute. What do you want to be? Do you, what kind of analyst do you want to be? And it is like very small, but also very fascinating because it doesn't leave room for like the spontaneity, the art, the like it's like when. Or when the kid's like, I want to be somebody who helps people. And they're like, yeah, we have droids for that. Like, what are you talking about? It's really, really small. But like we're talking about with Creature Commandos, these small moments of something, it's like, that means something. It's a very small moment in the first episode, but it means something to that character, and that's a thing that they're going to explore. And maybe, you know, it won't like set the universe on fire and like change Star Wars as we know it, but like seeing how that character now is now gonna like move through this universe, it's the kind of thing that like that could have lasting effects. You're talking about throwback stuff. There is a thing about power converters in this episode, in the two episodes that we got, that is, this is the thing that JJ couldn't get right. Like, JJ wanted to reference the original trilogy, but wound up really just ripping it off and not paying homage to it. It's just like, oh, hey, remember this chessboard? You know, just shit like that. It's like, okay, yeah, man, we all saw the movie. The power converter thing is a reference and homage to Luke without really drawing a lot of attention to itself.
Absolutely. And also, well, okay, so like, here's the thing that John Watts, I'm starting to figure out as a filmmaker, does wonderfully, which is that he takes something and gives it purpose, because it's not just referencing. It's just like, not, hey, remember when this happened? It's more like, because like it's a vital piece for Fern and KB, who are the two characters that are talking about power converters, but also it very much so is about like speed and like purpose, and like it gives it context where it's not just like, oh, let's just do a throwaway line. It has everything to do with these two characters, Fern and KB, and their sense of who they are as people, right? Like they're trying to like be like, it's all about racing, which is another thing that George loved, right? Like I could see George watching this and chuckling and smiling. Like the way that George, like that would be like George doing the Star Wars meme would be a chuckle. Like
if he, this is a show I very much feel like that George would have made if he could have made like this show in 1985.
Absolutely. And I'm going to make a statement here. Like, Wim's dad, who's Wendell, is literally George Lucas. The way he talks, his glasses, the fact that he's a huge nerd, an uncool nerd. Like, when has the last time we've had a father in anything that isn't just like a, like, oh, he's kind of a nerd, but at the end of the day, he's kind of cool. Like, Wendell is straight up a nerd and an uncool nerd, and a guy that literally when you watch him talk with his son, you're like, what the fuck, dude? You are so off base with your son and what you're trying to teach him and all this. Like I kind of appreciated the fact that we're back to this like 80s trope of like parents not understanding. And but also you being not understanding, like for the first time in a long time, I watched the parents, both like the other Farrah, the one that's played by Carrie Condon, the mother of Fern. Like I watched both of them. I was watching both of them and I'm like, I don't agree with anything you're fucking saying. I'm actually agreeing with your kids. And yeah, that is a magic trick that hasn't been done, or that is not a trick that's been pulled in a long time in a kid's show, because there always has to be some kind of truth to what the parents are saying, right? This one, it's like, nah, these kids are more right than you are. What the hell?
Yeah.
And I
love that guy too. The plays, yes, the dad. He's mostly been a voiceover guy for his career. I still haven't seen Twisters. You saw Twisters. I know, yes, he's in Twisters. Tunde Adebimpe. If I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize. But he was in Homecoming, right?
Yes.
Was it Homecoming he's in?
Yeah, he was one of the teachers.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Mr. Cobwell. And like, it's not a big thing. It's not a big moment, but like, I don't know. He was just kind of fun. Mm-hmm. You could speak to how good he is in Twisters, but he's fantastic here. And like, hopefully this is gonna lead to Twisters was a huge success. And hopefully this show will be successful and, you know, he'll get a bigger career out of this. But that he's fantastic. Like he plays it pitch perfect. And I'm excited to see like his kind of journey. He's listed for all 8 episodes. So I'm assuming, yeah, we're going to get at least a little bit, in every episode for him. One of the things in the Goonies that you don't see is the parents.
Yes.
Like it's all the kids' story, and there's no thing. We see the parents' stuff at the end, but we don't see like any of that stuff through their journey. So getting to see like his journey and trying to find his kid who's missing, it's, you know, I'm sure we're going to get that cathartic reunion at the end. And, you know, I'm sorry. Standard stuff, but, you know, it's there because it works when you do it right. Mm-hmm. And John Watts is certainly the kind of person that can do that right. So, and it's all about the journey and getting that emotional release at the end. So, I'm really looking forward to that. The effects work here. It's not a surprise that it's great.
No. But the production, how much of it is not, yeah, on the volume? Holy,
yeah,
shit.
Right.
Like that's, they use the volume thing purposely. Like when they end up at the Port Borgo, like,
yeah,
the only thing that's is the spaceport itself and the ships that are docking. Everything else is real. And it's like, I mean, even like, and shout out to Nick Frost finally getting something other than just, okay, his like small, huh?
Yeah, I was gonna say, good bringing up Nick Frost.
Yeah, the voice of SM-33, like, yeah, but also like the work,
fucking pirate droid, man. Are you kidding me?
A first mate pirate droid that ends up making Fern the captain. Like, okay, so like we have to talk about like Fern and KB as like the cool characters and the boys being like, I mean, isn't that always the way that it is? Girls mature faster than boys and like are smarter. They're just smarter. Like, I love the fact that that's the way, the angle that they approached this, and not making Wim the captain of the ship, like, and her just kind,
I mean,
of, like,
I'm sure that'll
annoying,
piss people off too. So,
oh God. Yeah. But fuck them. But Nick Frost, like, the moment that like the moment you see him, you don't know it's Nick Frost. It's not like, it's kind of like the Alan Tudyk thing where like when you saw him as what's his name in Rogue One, you didn't really realize it was until well into it. You're like, oh shit, that's fucking Alan Tudyk. Like, with Nick Frost, it's like, oh, that's Nick Frost. Like, at a certain point, it's, but it, the droid character itself is very much, like, you know how, like, Alan Tudyk is tall and thin and,
And kind of resembles Nick Frost.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But he's also a fucking brawler, and that fucking space pirate fight where he fucking protects the kids was so badass. Was just like this moment of like, oh shit. What I appreciated also was that this is a PG-13 show where the kids are in fucking true danger. Like, there's true danger for these fucking kids, and I'm not mad at it. Like, I don't like. This is truly a throwback to, like, this is not Star Wars as much as it is an Amblin joint. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like John Watts.
It is the perfect kind of, like, thing that you could stick that Amblin thing on. That I know we kind of shit on him a lot, and especially when Star Wars is concerned. But J.J. Abrams wanted so desperately to make something, like, that you could be like, yes, this is an Amblin film, like, even before Star Wars.
Super 8.
Yeah, but this captures what all of that was without feeling like it's just like, oh yeah, like, we've seen this before. Like, Super 8 was fine, but, like, it couldn't escape the, like, oh yeah, this is ET with Godzilla instead of a little dumpy monster kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. 100%. And I feel like this goes to the from top to bottom, head to stern. I think that this just goes by, like, the creative choices that Watts made with making this show, and like how, like, every little bit counts. And I feel like the difference between Watts and Abrams is Watts figures out a way to embed it that feels organic to the whole story, where JJ does the Quentin thing, or the thing that people think that Quentin does, which is, hey, nudge, nudge, you remember that time? But really, JJ never does that. Or I'm sorry, Quentin doesn't do that. Quentin just references things, but he also manages to do the thing that Watt does, which is
kind of like visual references, but not this, like, not the Family Guy kind of like, look at us, we're referencing this thing. You know, it doesn't draw attention to itself. It's thematic, and it's like a look or a feel. It's not a, like, hey, remember this? You love this. So, it's, again, I don't think it's a perfect show, and I'm not, like, completely in love with it yet. But, like, it certainly did get me, like, not hopeful, but, like, oh, yeah, like, this will be fun. It's completely different. I don't have to worry about, like, how it's going to affect the overall lore. It kind of feels Agatha All Along-ish, right?
It really does.
It's like, okay, so this isn't a major thing. But also, by the end, it could wind up being this major thing that we weren't expecting, specifically because there's somebody in the show we haven't talked about yet. We still haven't really seen his face.
Which talk
me
about
too.
Him. Yeah, talk about making him like a mystery. Like, I love the cliffhanger. I'm glad we got 2 episodes. I almost wish that we had gotten 3 like we did with Andor, because it leaves you with a fucking cliffhanger of a cliffhanger.
So, I mean, the first time you see him, though, he's a pirate. Like,
he's a pirate, yes.
And we knew he was going to be this kind of roguish, like, maybe bad Han Solo kind of figure. Like, you know, doesn't ultimately become altruistic. It's Jude Law. So, but seeing him in this, like, helmet and doing this, like, Jack Sparrow, if he wasn't, hapless drunk kind of thing, like that bravado and showmanship, but in a Star Wars outfit with a cool ass helmet on, was so much fun. And then like seeing like that whole pirate invasion thing, fucking fantastic, man. Like the way they board the ship was ingenious.
Oh God, it was truly like, it truly felt like Star Wars, but also it felt like a pirate. Like what a pirate.
Yeah, like literally that what they would do, like shoot like things into the ships, draw them close. Like that's taken from like pirate lore, you
exactly.
know? And it's just, it's so much fun to watch. Like that whole scene, it's great. And then how everything kind of falls apart. And you don't really find out what happened to him. And then you get to the end of the second episode and he kind of shows up and misrepresents himself as a Jedi.
Yes.
But does he have Force powers? Like, what's going on there?
I feel like he's a Force. Like, okay, so like this era of Star Wars has been really heavy on Force users and not Jedi.
Right.
And I almost wonder if he's a Force user and we're going to get another story like The Acolyte of someone who did not align with the strict, stern Catholic nature of the Jedi Order and left the Jedi Order, because that's something that's been since, like, Dave has made it a mission since Ahsoka left the Order to make it known that the Jedi are not this high and mighty pious like organization. They have major issues. And thus the reason why they were able to crumble as quickly as they were over a 10-year period after being there for hundreds of years. I feel like he is a Force user, but his, like you said, like his ethics and code of conduct did not align with them, so that he only got so far and became this kind of like Fagin, like you said, like Blackbeard type character, like this rapscallion that you could never trust, but like, you know, is charming in a way that, like, you know, that a pirate can be charming. I'm very intrigued by this whole thing of like how heartbreaking is it going to be when the kids find out that he is not fucking, he is like, if they're building it up to this point, like how heartbreaking is it going to be for the kids when they realize that he's lied to them, because they've never been lied to in their entire life. Right. And so like, if you're dealing with pirates, it's always about the double triple.
Yeah. Kind of the opposite of the Goonies. Like those kids were not like, they didn't have any like altruistic, like, things in their head about the world at large, whereas these kids kind of, at least two of them are kind of sheltered and don't really know that you can't trust everybody. So it's definitely set itself up for an interesting little party, you know, like these kids and this one dude who is definitely taking advantage of them and the fact that they have a ship and don't know what a piece of shit he is. So
I do have a couple of questions for you before we move on, because like ultimately you've summed it up perfectly. Like I feel like this is something that it's going to be a treat. It's going to be a holiday treat. Like, I feel like this is just going to get better and better. I feel like the directing lineup they got is fucking unreal. Like,
it's wild. Fucking
17th, I will be watching, like, I will be watching this before my wife, because I just want to see the Daniels direct something again. Yeah. Then they got Bryce Dallas Howard. And of course, they got Isaac Lee Chung to come back. David Lowery, like, who'd have thought that?
That's
like,
interesting choice, man. So he directed the second episode, right?
And the third.
And the third, which we haven't seen yet. So it's interesting that, so we're getting bookended by Watts. He's the first and the last episode. Lowry directed the second and the third episode. So, like, I'm kind of with you there that if we'd have gotten the first three, like, those two episodes are going to be, like, really, probably really cohesive. And you have
Yes.
Watts setting the stage and giving us the finale, which is perfect. He's such an interesting choice. I wonder where that came from. Like everybody else, I kind of get,
Have
like
you
the
seen?
Daniels have been, circling stuff like this. So
So he directed Peter Pan, which I'm gonna say is not a bad adaptation. Like
I
I feel
Ryan liked it. That's this was it the Peter Pan and Wendy? I think that's the one he. When did that come out?
The one that Jude Law, that came out, I think, in 2022.
Oh, then Ryan didn't see it.
Let me see here.
Which one? Oh, he liked the real dark one that came out before that.
Oh, yes, I know which one you're talking about.
Pan. I think it was just called
Pan.
Pan. Yeah. Sorry, I got him confused.
But he did the Peter Pan and Wendy. That was in 2023. So, and
I haven't seen that.
it's Jude Law plays Hook. So you know why they kind of got him because of the connection to that. But have you seen his movie The Green Knight with Dev Patel?
I haven't. I really
Oh
wanted to, and
man.
I haven't.
It's okay. It's perfect right now because it's a Christmas story. It takes place during two Christmases. It has Dev Patel at that moment where everyone went, Dev Patel? Okay. It's the movie that got him Monkey Man, which ended up like we know the story of Monkey Man, but that one is like that. I really love The Green Knight. Like I love that movie. I'm actually gonna be watching it because as soon as I saw his name, I was like, fuck, I gotta watch that movie again.
I
It's
didn't see
very
his Peach Dragon either, and I wanted to see that.
That one is tough. Like I can't watch it. But that was a one and done because it's so emotional. Like it starts off with a parent dying, and then it doesn't get kind of. It's kind of got that very much How to Train Your Dragon, broken people fixing broken animals, and like it's good. Bryce Dallas Howard is in that one. She plays the mother, and then Robert Redford plays the grandfather. But it is one of those ones that it's like at the end I was a fucking bawling mess because of like everything that happens. So just beware. He's legitimately like I feel like he doesn't get enough credit for how good of a director he is, especially because
I've only seen one movie he directed.
oh really?
So that
Which one?
was a decade ago. Ain't Them Body Saints. That's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Ain't Them Body Saints is great. Like that's
Yeah.
like a regardless of the fact that who stars in
That
it.
was the thing I was like, this guy to direct Star Wars? Okay. But I mean, that second episode, it's pretty damn good.
Well, he did this movie like it was probably one of my favorite like top three movies of 2018 called The Old Man and the Gun.
Yeah.
And like fucking Robert Redford in that motherfucker is so good. It's it's a great movie. Like it's a legitimately great movie that no one watched. So like his work, like I'm always down for. Like he's like one of those guys that I've kind of like consistently loved and watched. And like I said, Green Knight, I think you can find it. I think it's on Netflix or one of the streaming services. Watch it. Because like legitimately it's like a great fantasy film, but it's an adult fantasy film. Like the thing that I can say about it is that it's like Excalibur. It's the closest to Excalibur that I've seen recently in the way that it takes the magic and fantasy of it all very seriously. But it grounds it in a very, very like earthy like setting. So it makes sense to me that they would have him come on for at least one episode. But yeah, like the direction in this already is like top notch. And also just the decisions they're making. The one big question I have for you, because I almost feel like they could hide it in plain sight and we would never fucking have known until it happens. Because they're dealing with pirates, what do we think the odds are that Dave made one note, or if John Watt is enough of a Star Wars fan, he asked, do we get a live action version of Hondo Ohnaka finally?
I hope so. That's one of the things that most excited me. Like, I kind of knew the, like, roguishness of it. I didn't know where we were going, like, full on, like, this is all space pirate shit. And a live action Hondo would be, like, it would be such a great celebratory thing. Like, it's one thing, I think, across the board, like, even the people who don't currently love Star Wars, we've kind of been clamoring, like, oh, give us Hondo. It would be interesting if they try to shoehorn Billy Dee into this in some way, shape, or form.
Or Donald. Because yeah. I feel like at this point, Donald, like, the time, like, this is the fucking crazy part is, okay, so when we meet Lando in Empire and the time frame between that and post where we are right now is probably about the same amount of time that from where Solo is to where Empire, like, where we are in the timeline, it would make sense where we first meet him in Solo to where we see him in... Where we could justifiably age him up enough to where he is post Jedi, because like Solo is only supposed to be, like, I think they said it's supposed to be only 5 years before Star Wars. So
yeah, so you could age him up and make him look a little bit older and more Lando-ish.
Like, all he needs is, like, I mean, we see him with the mustache recently. Yeah. All he really need is the fucking, I mean, like, you give him the cape and it's done, right?
Yeah, like, he's got the vocal thing down, so yeah.
Yeah.
It would be fun. It would be fun to see Lando and Hondo kind of bumming around, even if it's only for, you know, a little bit. I'm really excited to see where the show goes. I feel like, much like Agatha, it's the kind of thing, it could take missteps and I could ultimately wind up not enjoying it just because it was fine. But I really do feel like it could be that Agatha thing of like, oh no, like I'm really into this. Oh wait, this is really good. Oh wait, this is exceptional. Oh my God, I can't believe they pulled this off. Holy shit, it ties into the lore and what we're doing going forward, you know? Mm-hmm. And most importantly, Star Wars fans as a whole kind of just can't grasp this. This shit was always meant for kids. This is a show for kids. And
100%.
I can truly, truly appreciate that. So, the last show we want to talk about is, and we can talk about the entire show. I talked about it a little bit last week, but there's a new show on Netflix starring Ted Danson called A Man on the Inside. You finally got to watch the show. I'm assuming you and your wife both watched it.
Yes, absolutely.
So, my question isn't whether you enjoyed the show. It's how much did you cry?
Oh, Lord. This show is so kind of like, man, I can't even describe how special it is. Like, it's one of those shows that you just, like, at the end, my wife was, like, in tears. Like, it's just, it's one of those shows that it just, like.
Those last two episodes or something. Oh, fucking. God. Like, are really the kind of the last three, like, from it's there's what, 8 episodes?
Yes.
I watched it twice all the way through.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I think it's the 6th episode where a character dies and we're like suddenly, and you're kind of having to deal with that and watch him deal with that. And like, his reciting at the funeral, or not the funeral, but the memorial service.
The memorial,
it's just,
yeah.
Yeah, it's, I can just, wow.
Yeah, like, it's a very special show because it is both about the detecting, but it's absolutely not about the detecting. Like, he's gone back to the, like, in a weird way, like, when I had heard about it and I saw what it was about, I was like, oh man, he kind of went back to the, no, he didn't. No,
yeah,
he didn't. Like, he uses, like, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, yeah, it's about a bunch of cops in a precinct, but it's not. Like, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is not about that. Like, if you were to, like, if you were to tell me, if somebody were to describe Brooklyn Nine-Nine as just a cop show, I'd probably take my silk glove off and smack them and ask them for a duel, because it's not. Like, and it's insulting to that show to call Brooklyn Nine, just like calling, like, Parks and Rec or The Office a workplace comedy, because they're not. They're more than that. And he took this delivery system of, like, this this unexpected detective series and made it about, like, family and loss and loneliness in a way that you just don't expect it to hit you. And still done in the Michael Schur way, which a dollop of comedy, but also just like this ability to learn about new people and, like, find out about this, like by the end of A Man on the Inside, you know all of these characters so well. Like, he gets, like, it just starts running right away. Like, you find out about all these characters, like, and you continue to find out about these characters. And it's like, it's this wonderful way of, like, approaching the world that you're building without showing the seams of world building. It's a wonderful, like, written show and constructed show. It's like, again, a magic trick that they pull off that I, like, you watch it and you just go, how did they manage to do this and get so much character into something that's primarily about a mystery about who, and the way that it solves the mystery is so wonderful and so yeah. Beautiful.
And I like, and I know it's based on, like, a true
story.
Thing.
Yeah.
I like, it's a mystery show about a mystery that isn't fucking, like, earth shattering. Like, nobody, like, somebody did die, but it's not about a murder. It's not about, like, this old woman's necklace got stolen. And, you know, yes, this is a rich old folks home. But it is what it is. Like, it's also like, yeah, all our seniors kind of, they deserve, like, better from us in general. And there's this whole, like, underlying plot of, like, the biggest health crisis seniors actually face is loneliness.
Yes, yeah.
And the fact that the people, you know, they've spent their lives with kind of just abandon them in their old age. But yeah, it's so sweet. Michael Schur is able to do something that a lot of, like, modern comedy makers can't really do, outside of probably Bill Lawrence. And also he's like said, speaking of Bill Lawrence, Scrubs, they're working on it, apparently actively working on Scrub revival. We didn't talk about that, but they can blend heart and cynicism in a way that a lot of modern, like, TV comedy makers can't really do. Like, yeah, the heart is either way too much and, like, it feels schmaltzy in shows that try to be really heartfelt, are, like, it's just overtaken by cynicism. Like, I talked about St. Denis, and I do still think it's doing a really, really good job, but 95% of that show is so cynical, and it's only, like, the last little bit that's heart. This is, like, equal parts cynicism and heart, And it walks that line, and it's funny, and just every episode hits you with this like little bit of something, you
Yeah,
know.
like, and sometimes it's a lot of something. Like it, but it's done so well. Like, the most heartbreaking part about this show for me was realizing that that this feels like this, like in another, like if he had lived long enough, that this wouldn't have been Danson, but it would have been Andre Brower. Like
Yeah.
this show feels like it's designed for both, but you can almost feel like if Schur started this at the, like it was intended to be, or he was a part of it,
Yeah,
because
he would at the very least have been a part of it. Yeah.
exactly, if not had been Charles Nieuwendyk, because it's just the construction of the character feels like a love letter to Andre Brower and everything he was. I mean, he's a retired engineering college professor.
Yeah.
Like it, like there's this like it's just like a detective. It feels like as much as I love Danson in this role, and he's wonderful. Jesus Christ, is he wonderful! Like between like him, like I did not know I needed the pairing of him and John Getz together.
Yeah.
Who plays Elliot Haverhill, his sexual rival?
The stuff between them is so funny. If there is more, like I don't think it'll be, it probably obviously won't be set in the same place,
Yeah.
but that's a shame because the older actors in this work so well together that it's a shame to lose that kind of chemistry. By the end, I just wanted to show this show set in this community. I didn't need the like, I need Ted Danson, but I just need Ted Danson living in this community with these characters, with these specific actors, and seeing how they continue to interact with each other because it was so much fun. I mean, Sally Struthers, for decades, we've kind of just slept on, oh yeah, shit, we forgot how good Sally Struthers is.
Yeah. Or, Veronica Cartwright too.
Yep.
Like they've got a murderer's row of like really great like older actresses. Margaret Avery, who plays Flo, who I'd completely forgot was somebody that I kind of like actually knew, and was like, where the hell do I know her from? And she played Suge in
In The Color Purple,
Color Color
yeah.
Purple. This, let's be clear, the Steven Spielberg
Yeah,
Color Purple.
yeah.
But she's also done like a bunch of stuff that I remember, and I'm like, oh shit, she like the thing about the show is that it makes us remember that these people are not the like these actors and actresses are not just like they're not just playing old people, but they're like literally they have like great characters that they're playing, like Sally Struthers, playing the center of an unintended triangle between John Getz and Ted Danson, which is so great. But then she gets those moments, those serious moments where she has to confront Getz's character, you
Yeah.
know. Or talk about, like, I mean, the eulogy, like, Jesus Christ, the eulogy that she has, like, the friendship that she has with Flo, and then, you know, what happens, and it's just, you're right, like, we've really forgotten who Sally Struthers was because of her charity work, and we've made her a joke, like, I know that I was a part of that, you know, the Sally Struthers.
At some point, it got hard not to be because Like it was, you're just getting bombarded with it, and you become cynical to it, you know? Like it's, but yeah, it's just a damn shame that, like, oh yeah, shit, I forgot how good Sally Struthers was. And like Stephanie Beatriz, who is, you know, not, she's not huge, but she's definitely like made a name for herself in a lot of ways, partially because of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. But you could kind of pigeonhole her into that Brooklyn Nine-Nine character. And if you're a fan of that show, when she shows up here, it's kind of hard not to see her as a version of that character. Like, so much so that at some point they make her the focal point, like you think she's the
She's the
person.
yeah. Also like she's so like she's such a good vocal actress that you don't realize she's like the lead in Encanto unless you saw the Encanto live. Like she definitely has moved away from the Rosa of it all to give us like, and I think like it's kind of wonderful that Schur allowed her to be this character, like
Yeah,
cast her.
very, very vulnerable, very heartfelt. It's not something like, even like we saw her in Twisted Metal,
And she's
which I'm,
playing the kind of that's
yeah.
fairly soon. But she's playing basically the Rosa Hardass, right? Like, not playing this kind of role, and it's wonderful like how she like makes a meal out of this role, and it never feels cliched, right? Like, and that's the thing that I love about the show is like leave it to Michael Schur to make a show that always like the twists are never what you expect the twist to be, but it totally surprises you because of the fact that Schur designs his shows to be unexpectedly like twisty, because they're never, it's never like what you expect them to do. And I love that. Like, I love the fact that Stephanie Beatriz is casted because we have this like this relationship with her, but like, you know, the way that this show continually evolves that and uses that to its advantage, it's fucking great. It's great.
He also
It's
does something like wonderful with the not old person stuff in the show, where
yes.
we get to see Charles's family. His relationship with his daughter is a big part of it, played wonderful by she's wonder Mary Elizabeth Ellis, who,
Yes.
you know, everybody knows from Always Sunny, but
Sunny.
she's been in so much stuff. Like, she's not just the waitress, or aka Charlie Day's wife.
Wife.
But her relationship and her kids, like, he does this very real modern interpretation of like what kids are currently like, but he doesn't get cynical about it. Like, they do get a little like exasperated with the bra stuff,
Oh,
and
yeah.
you know, but it's never like, oh, we hate our children kind of thing. Like, oh, well, it's just kind of who they are. And I really, really enjoyed that. It's a small thing, but it is nice that it's not somebody being, oh, look how shitty kids are today. It's like, oh yeah, these are the kids today, and we're just not going to be shitty about it. I like that.
Yeah, I also appreciated that, like, Eugene Cordero, who plays her husband,
He's so great, man.
he really is, but like what me and my wife know him for is playing Pillboy in The Good Place, and we call him Pillboy. Like, we don't even call him Eugene Cordero. Like, we just like when we first saw him, we looked at it, I was like, fucking Pillboy has kids? Not only just one kid, but three kids. But it's so great to watch him like be something that isn't Pillboy, right? Or anything that he's like kind of usually played in the different shows that he's been in. And then shout out to, did you know that one of the kids is played by Dante Basco's son?
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, like I mean, Dante Basco, who, for like, you know, anybody who's a 90s kid will know, is Rufio. Like, you know, and has made a comeback like for his own, in his own way, in the independent world, becoming a director and star of like a couple of comedies and stuff. But his son is actually, from what I understand, he's also a voice actor, because he was in Raya and the Last Dragon. But
okay. Bruce
Basco has become quite the little actor, and he's the sensitive one. That's who he plays. The sensitive of the three bruh guys. but I found much delight in the way that the relationship between the kids and the parents were, and the grandfather, and how like this blended family kind of like. I love the fact that the kids give their mom shit for not knowing that
what's going on with him.
Was going through a hard time, though she has her own issues, but she doesn't make it about her, right? Like, she just kind of like.
Well, I also really like that. So there's also a mystery that you didn't know was a mystery that gets solved in the show. And I mean, kind of, we're talking about it, so spoilers, but there's this thing literally in the first episode. She talks about how when her mom died, that Charles, her dad, just packed all her mom's stuff up the same day. And like, they just haven't spoken about it since. And then in the last episode, you find out that he didn't pack her stuff up. That he had reached out and was moving her into a memory care facility because it had become too much for him to handle by himself. And like, he was so distraught about having broken this promise to his wife, because he told her she would never have to leave her house, that's why he didn't talk about it. And like, the reveal of that to his daughter, like, it's such this emotionally cathartic moment, and it's played perfectly by both of them, but specifically Danson. Like, he, this whole show, he does such a good job of walking like this like edge of like silly, goofy, like elated thing. The moment with the kids where they're playing video games and then they win, and he just bursts into tears.
Yeah, that was that, like, talk about taking a slice from real life, right? Like, the whole thing of like how quickly it churns. It's so beautiful. Like, the show is just so, like, it's one. But then they take the video game thing and they give you another emotional pop at the end, where like, once everything is solved and he goes back to his life, and we start seeing how everybody is interacting post post solving the mystery. And you see he has his own gaming setup, so that he can play with not only his grandkids, but his daughter, online. And it's kind of like, it's like this wonderful little pop of like, you know, like, I mean, you know, we're both gamers, like how, like, most of the time gaming is done in a way that kind of feels like bad and dirty. And this one is kind of like, no, it's about connection. And it's kind of wonderful, like to see this little moment like that, because that's the way that kids would connect with, like, and like, it also kind of says something about him, like Charles, about like how wonderful he is as a person, finding a way to connect with people, right? Yeah. But maybe not knowing, like, but being imperfect about it, like, because of what I love so much is the fact that he's trying to connect with his daughter. He's just doing it the wrong way. Like, he's doing it in the way that he thinks that it should be done, right? With the news clippings. And she just doesn't understand it. She's like, what the fuck? I want to talk to you. I want to be around you. I don't want these newspaper clippings. And how that's also a through line. It's a really wonderful show. Like, it's like, I I don't know what I was expecting, but it was not this. But I should have been expecting the amount of heart and charm and loveliness that this show kind of like imbues on you. It's like, yeah, it's emotional and sometimes it's hard to like watch, but it's so lovely to be in this world. And to spend a few hours here. It's like the thing that you instantly want is you want them to have already had another series. Like it was definitely the way that I felt about when I first started watching The Good Place, which is like, oh man, I have to wait how many years for another fucking season of it. And like, you know, the promise of it is definitely like, you know, another mystery. But I wonder how much, like, it's not going to be about the old folks home, but I almost guarantee, I feel like Charles, something's going to happen to Charles where he's going to have to be forced to move there. Do you know what I mean? Like, the conceit is too, like, that place is too rich of a grounds to not put him back in there. But I almost think that he's going to be purposely put there. Like, either his house gets destroyed in an earthquake or something that makes him have to go back there so that we're forced to deal with, not forced, but like it allows the story to unfold there more. I mean, he has his friends, right? Like he has.
Yeah. I really wish it had ended with him deciding oh, he sold his house. He's moving into this place. And that like, if/when we get a season two, it's him doing this, but also involving the other residents in his detective work so that we get to see kind of them being bumbling spies too, you know?
Well, I think
that would be fun.
I think that that's what's going to happen. I think that we're going to get that. I think that they're just going to leave the building blocks of it for the first part of the show. Because like this show, it first starts off with like, dude, you didn't warn me. Damn, with this like a rough first 10 minutes of a show.
Yeah, it's very up of like,
yeah,
oh yeah, you get this like really sweet moment. They do a pretty good job making Ted Danson look young. And then smash cut to him laying in bed by himself with the gray hair, and it's just like, oh god, well I know what happened here.
Yeah. The one thing I do hope after it all is that they do not like, we keep the wife as a presence that you don't have to see. And I know that sounds strange, because my inclination is that they're gonna cast Mary Steenburgen if they do like past, because how do you not, and B, how do you swirl around the Sure universe like Mary Steenburgen has, because Ted has been involved with so many projects with Sure, and not involve her? Or she could also become a late blooming love affair for him.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. I like, because then it has to contend with his loss of his wife and what that means. Like that would be fucking wonderful. But it's all, say, I'm on board for a season two. I almost wish that I hadn't discovered this. And like 3 years later, I have four seasons to watch, because it's that kind of wonderful.
I mean, like I said, I watched it twice. I know it's only 8 episodes, but those 8 episodes, like most of the stuff Michael Schur does, cemented itself where I'm like, oh, this will be a thing that I rewatch over and over and over and over and over again. And it just, in an immediate rewatch, it didn't lose anything. It still made me laugh. It still made me cry. It's, you know, and so it will, hopefully as it grows, it'll become one of those like background shows where I have like a stash of episodes that I put on and just let play, and I just come in and out of it, you know, and catch those moments. It's absolutely wonderful. I know it's been fairly popular for Netflix. Like it's always on there. Like for 2 weeks, it's been on their like, you know, top 5 or 10 or whatever it is. So hopefully that's a huge sign, and they will announce, you know, pretty soon that I like, oh yeah, we're gonna make more episodes. So
yeah, no, I really do hope so too. I'm glad that they're in the sure business, because I feel like you said, I don't think we've mentioned this, but the best thing to happen to Bill Lawrence is Apple TV.
Yeah. I was just about to say it, like, I Chuck Lorre still has like a foothold in actual network television, and that's great. I'm happy for him. I don't love everything he does, but streaming, like seeing what it's done for Bill Lawrence's career, mm-hmm. and now hopefully Michael Schur, because like his shows have done fine on network TV.
Yeah.
But it's the reruns that have really gotten, like, put those into the pop culture stratosphere, like catching them in reruns. So like I can see why Netflix would want to be like, oh, we need to tap into this and create something original.
Which is the way you approach it, rather than like, you know, rather than rebuying The Office 5, like releasing The Office like 7 or 8 times, give this dude his like I like that that Apple has influenced this in one way, in a good way, which is that it's like, oh, we like Scrubs, let's just talk to Bill Lawrence and see what he has. Hey, Bill, what do you have? Well, I've got like these 35 ideas. Okay, no, let's hold on. And then doing one thing at a time, but like progressively allowing him to have more and more freedom, but also like smartly scooping up things that, like, you know, like the Ted Lasso begat Shrinking, right? Yeah. And Shrinking begat Bad Monkey. And now we're in a place where it's like, oh man, like we have 3 truly great shows on this network. Or on this thing that like nobody ever watches except for Ted Lasso, right? And like hopefully Sure is allowed to continue the Sureverse and figure it out in Netflix and what that means to him in Netflix. And if it's something like A Man on the Inside, man, we are in for a treat. Like we are going to like have Ted Lasso style like successes, or Shrinking style successes, because what I liked about the show is that he didn't like, I love that Bill Lawrence, like you could tell Bill Lawrence wants to curse. Like he's like the guy that like toes the line between PG-13 and R. And he kind of like has been allowed in the last 3 series to go really R, right? But a justified R. I like the fact that Sure still has the ability to go R, but he's like, I like the PG-13 of it all. Like
it really hits at home when Danson lets something fly.
Yes.
Like it feels more, it sounds weird to say badass, but it does, you know, it's like, it's weirdly kind of like that moment in X-Men First Class where they walk into the bar and Wolverine just says, fuck off. And it's just like, yeah. You know, it's like that kind of moment where it's like, oh, we're going to hit that PG-13. We're going to save it for like a really great moment. And, you know, like Danson, like, does a really good job of like relishing and selling those things where it feels cool, you know. Yes. But then he can also do the like kind of sit like the very last shot of the season is him getting that phone call and he's like, say no more, I'm in. And then like doing this like mugging the camera like James Bond kind of thing, then literally taking the phone out of its pocket and calling her back and being like, actually I do need you to tell me more, but I'm more, in. Yes.
But also the coat the pocket square. And that being a touchstone for him, that was one of my favorite, like the way that he used the pocket square to like identify what he he was at work and when he wasn't. And like, when he started his friendship with Talbert, like how he takes it out. It's kind of like wonderful that he puts it back in and you're like, oh shit, this is like the Superman taking off his glasses. It's just great. Like, it's great that you're going to have another, like, you're going to have another mystery. Now, if they don't do a ship at sea mystery, I feel like at a certain point in a season, I feel like it's going to be wasted because they have to do an old people, a senior citizens at sea kind of
senior citizen cruise thing. Yeah, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Where you get like where the company, because you know that the thing that I feel like it's just starting with the series, but I feel like it's going to be a big thing because Schur always does this with his work, is big institutions. He always takes on big institutions, whether it's to criticize them or to promote them. And we have just started with this company that, okay, can we just say, why don't we live in a world where all seniors get to go to one of these places?
Yeah, it's
right. Yeah. Like, it's almost like the Good Place. Like, it's almost too good to be true. Like, if I found out that this was just
I want to live here, man.
Yes. Like, I don't want to fucking live here. I don't want to go to a fucking random. I want to go to a random fucking Giants game in San Francisco. Do you know how much fucking money those seats cost? Those are like $500 seats. No, like, this isn't like, I love the fact that the Schur universe is a fantasy, but they're all connected. Like, we later found out, like, the Good Place and Brooklyn Nine-Nine are part of the same universe. Like, they're like in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, when somebody goes to heaven, they really truly do go to the Good Place, right? Like, I almost wonder, like, I almost hope that this is also a part of the Schurverse. Like, there's going to be some kind of connective tissue that we can get, because it's like, it's almost too good to be true, right? Like, but like, we've already seen the seeds like planted for this, like, and like the kind of institutional stuff that they're going to be taking on, which is wonderful because you get what's his name from New Girl also as a side character. He's in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I always call him Como because like he's Como, but I can't think of his name. The guy who has the glasses.
Yeah.
Who's aged? Like, he's gone from like a 20-year-old to like a 40-year-old in 5 years. But I can't think of his name. But he's a part of the, what is it called? West Wing or West Wilds? I can't remember what the old age home is called. New Horizons? Shit, I can't think of it. But anywho, I really do love the fact that he's going to be taking on
Nelson Franklin. Here. That's his name.
Yes, that's his real name, Nelson Franklin. Not Como, but he is Como to everybody who's seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Yeah. But it's like that kind of deep bench roster and character. And
well, that's the thing about Michael Schur is that like he's worked with a lot of people. He's not burned any bridges. If he has, it's not public. And so, like, you see bits and pieces of people from other shows. Mark Evan Jackson shows up very briefly. What's her name that plays in The Good Place? That's the not robot, but, you know, the little helper.
Oh, yeah, Darcy Carden.
Well, yeah. She literally shows up for one scene in this show.
Yeah, and it's with Ted Danson, and it's lovely, and it's wonderful. And I think that's what got me questioning. Is this in The Good Place?
Yeah.
are we in The Good Place?
I mean, I could easily see it, like, any of the people that he's worked with, like, showing up here as, you know, scheduling allows, you know, like, even for just a minute or two. So, yeah, it's going to be absolutely wonderful if they can keep this going. I'd like to see more episodes. I wish we were getting 22 episodes of this, but I also understand, like, this is a model that kind of works for what you're wanting to do. Eight episodes a year, okay, you know, I can deal with that. It gives me eight episodes of wonderful television and Ted Danson having the time of his life every year. I'm okay with that.
Absolutely. If every Thanksgiving, like during the Thanksgiving period, I'm getting a new a man on the inside, and it's as casted and written as lovely as this is. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Me 4 hours in this universe every year for the next 5 years. Oh, hell yeah. Give me an Andy Samberg as the villain season. Give me Terry Crews coming in as like the CEO of the old age home. Yes. Give me it all because I want to see it all. Give me Dirt Blocker and Scully and Hitchcock. Give me them as new residents. Like, come on. Like, there's just, it's like, yes, please. Give me it all because I want it all, and I'll lap it up. And, you know, my only note is next time, give him like it's too bad that they made him allergic to a dog because, like, you know, sure, right, dogs better.
I wonder if Ted Danson's actually allergic to dogs.
I would,
or if that just felt like a thing, like you
because
know,
of the dog's crochet thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's and like I said, if it is as successful as we hope it will be and is for Netflix, then, you know, we see more, not just of this show, but more from Mike Schur on Netflix. So because much like Bill Lawrence, more Mike Schur projects, not a bad thing. So, yeah, it's oh, absolutely wonderful fucking week of television. Like, what a wonderful week of television.
Absolutely. And it's just starting. Like, most, like, other than A Man on the Inside, we've got more episodes for the other two, which is kind of great, but also kind of disappointing because I kind of want to see it all right now.
So next week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going. I don't.
Have you already seen the 8 minutes?
No.
Did you watch the first 8 minutes on YouTube?
No.
Okay.
Should I? Is that what
you're talking about? No. I refuse. Like, I'm gonna watch. Oh, like that's what
we're talking about. Craven, right?
Craven. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. The movie where Aaron Taylor Johnson keeps on losing his accent. Yeah.
I mean, him and the director. I'm drawing a blank on his name. Who directed it? J.C. Chandor, right?
J.C. Chandor. Yeah, that's right.
They've been like practically begging people to go see this movie and just give it a chance. I was going to go see it anyway. I'm always down for a train wreck, hopefully one that's under 2 hours. So right now I'm assuming we're going to talk about Kraven the Hunter next week.
pretty much. I feel like I'll go to like an early matinee screening in IMAX. Yeah. The thing that gives me hope is the fact that they got Richard Wink, who's a crime writer, who also wrote, all three of a personal favorite old man movies of mine, which is Jesus, I can't even think of the names now. Denzel.
The Equalizer.
The Equalizer. He wrote all three of the Equalizers, which are progressively sillier and sillier, but still managed to be a very specific, very entertaining kind of movie. So like, him being hired to do the story and had some of the screenplay credit, I hope that, like, there's this hope for me that Wenk was able to get some of his, like, you know, some of his, like, you know, hard-boiledness in there. But, man, everything I see just feels like just, oh my God, what is going on here? Like, you do you know what I mean? Like, even more so than, at least I know with The Last Dance, I knew what we were getting. And we pretty much got what we want, what was advertised, right? Here, I don't know, man.
Has J.C. Chandor not directed a movie since 2019, but I think that Craven's been finished for almost 2 years.
It's been, it's like 2020. 2021 or something, or 2022. I think it was the end of 2022 was when we knew Craven was finished. And then it became this whole thing of like reshoots. So yeah, but Triple Frontier, yeah, I'll like, that was okay.
I didn't see it, but
so I read the original script because I knew somebody who worked on it. And it was at the time that Kathryn Bigelow was supposed to direct it. And it was a very different movie. And it was also a very, like, it was actually a different cast. And that movie would have worked because it was basically like the Wild Bunch set in South America with drug dealers. And then this one became something very much different, and Netflix and Ben Affleck of it all. It's okay, but it's not.
You have the guy that made Margin Call, All Is Lost, and A Most Violent Year, making a super power something movie. It's just fascinating to me. So like, I'm really excited to see how terrible this could be, and if it winds up not being terrible, like, I won't even know what to do. Like, I'm weirdly anticipating seeing this movie. So right now, definitely talking about Craven next week. Who knows what else we'll see. Until then, you can check out everything else we're doing over at xfiles.com, or you can check out our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieisle.com, where I just finished a run of a bunch of 4Ks that I reviewed. And also, I have my first real review of a film that's being released this week.
Night Bitch?
Yeah.
I saw that. I saw your review, not the movie.
Yeah.
I've heard good things about the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a character piece more than it is a like movie with a story. But Amy, you go to see Amy Adams. Like, she's like, I love her. She's the GOAT. Like, she really does. Like, when you see the movie, you're genuinely surprised at how hard she goes into the raging bull of it all and changing her, like, her appearance physically. But like, also how goddamn charming and hard she goes at this role. It's quite a wonderful performance, more so than the movie itself. So Muriel Heller, who's actually married to Jorma Taccone, directed the film. She's become quite the director. Like, she specializes in these movies where it's very slight. It's not like, it's like A Wonderful Day in the Neighborhood, you know, like she directed and it's not a movie. It's not a movie with a story about, like, you know, Fred Rogers and how he became Mr. Rogers. That's the documentary. The movie is about Fred Rogers and how he, like, who he was as a person. It doesn't have a story in it. It's just Hanks. Like, the more I see that movie, the more I appreciate what it did, because the documentary did so much of what traditionally we would know as a biography. But this one just kind of let Hanks be Rogers and show us what made Rogers special. It's very similar to that, where it's just about this character and you don't even get a name. It's very kind of Fight Club-esque because she's called Mother. Like she's credited as Mother, but she tells the story and her story in it. The more I think about it, the more vital this story is about women who get their agency taken away from them because they had a fucking child. And I say it that way because it's weird because the movie is angry, but it's angry with the softest of touches. Like, it's so much so that it doesn't, like, and I know why they did it. And you can infer whatever the fuck you want about this, guys, but it's a movie that makes a man understand. It woman-splains what motherhood does to women because of society and because of other women and mostly because of men. But it does it with such a light and humorous touch and with this weird magical realism of her turning into a dog. It works. I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. Next week, there's another movie coming out called The Last Showgirl, which is Pamela Anderson's movie with Gia Coppola, who is Like, I feel yeah, so.
I've heard good things about it too.
And it's a very similar movie. Like, if you did a double feature of these two movies about these two women in their specific time, because it doesn't have a plot to it. Like, I can talk about this. I don't give a shit because there's so many reviews out there. Pamela Anderson is wonderful because she defies, like, everything that, like, you would think that the character would do, she doesn't. And it's just this wonderful movie where it's just a slice of somebody's life that's super important, and it's changing, and it's how they react to that. It's no story, no plot, just character. Very 70s style movies, though Night Bitch is very much a studio-produced movie, and The Last Showgirl is a very indie movie, and it feels it. They both feel it. You can feel like both of them are on this opposite sides of the spectrum of budget and production and what would be produced about these subjects. But that will be, I'll have a review for that next week. But this week, Night Bitch, and I definitely suggest people see it because it's actually a genuinely great movie. Though it's slight in its greatness because it doesn't tell a story. It's literally 90 minutes long. I went back to like write my review and I'm like, man, this thing's only 90 minutes and it just does this one thing, but it does it so fucking well. And it's so funny and it's so well observed. So it's very much so what I like to call an eight and a half movie where that's where we get really interesting movies that are really good and they take some risks and some of it works and some of it doesn't. So that just got posted on Thursday. So you can read that or you could read all of my Blu-ray reviews as well. And then, like I said, next week, Logan's Movie Pictures is coming back for the final three run, which will bring us into the new year, which heck I feel yeah. is always a good thing. So,
all right. Well, we will see you guys next week talking about Kraven the Hunter. I can't wait. Number 3, Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit. Number 4, Mario. Number 5, Weird Al. Number 6, Batman. Number 7, Kal-El. Number 8, The Simpsons. Number 9, TV. Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s. But before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything.